Welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It is Friday, August 28th, 2026, and you are listening to our Macro, Geopolitics, and Investing Evening Edition.
Today, we are examining the widening fracture between sovereign debt obligations and national solvency. We are moving from an era of assumed fiscal stability into a period defined by the fundamental tension between state authority and creditor demands.
Essentially, the math of the modern nation-state is no longer adding up.
Two things stand out. And that instability is forcing a total reassessment of how we value long-term state credit.
We begin by looking directly at the heart of the great debt debate, sovereignty and solvency. The U.S. Treasury is currently spending more on interest payments for our national debt than we spend on our entire defense budget. It's a bit of a heavy way to start a Friday, but tonight we're looking at the great debt debate, sovereignty versus solvency.
It's a fundamental shift in the math of the superpower Maya. We are moving from a period of managing stability to a period of managing structural volatility, driven by a $40 trillion debt pile and a complete reconfiguration of who actually owns the underlying pieces of the American economy.
So instead of a quiet, boring pile of government IOUs held by sleepy central banks, we now have a high-stakes poker game.
So here's the picture. The Ezra Klein Show highlighted a massive structural shift. The Treasury market has transitioned from a stable base of price-agnostic holders, like central banks, to a volatile ecosystem where highly leveraged hedge funds now hold nearly 8% of the market. To put that in perspective, that 8% is more than the combined holdings of Japan, China, and Saudi Arabia.
That sounds like we've replaced the librarians with professional gamblers.
It's more like replacing a dam with a series of much thinner, much more reactive valves. When you have that much leverage, you create a systemic fault line. If borrowing costs rise, it doesn't just cause a slow drift in yields, it can trigger forced correlated sell-offs. The traditional rule that Treasury yields fall during a crisis, because everyone rushes to safety, might be breaking because the safety itself is now a source of contagion.
And I assume Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent isn't just sitting there watching the water rise.
Not at all. He's implementing his 3-3-3 plan. Aiming for a 3% deficit to GDP ratio, 3% growth, and a 3 million barrel daily increase in oil production. He's also using increased bond buyback programs to try and manage specific yield levels. But as Robin Wigglesworth has argued, these interventions are effectively a water pistol against a wildfire. The multi-billion dollar buybacks are mathematically insignificant against the trillion-dollar daily trading volume of the Treasury market.
It's a very expensive way to try and stay calm.
It's also creating a massive policy tension within the Trump administration. On one hand, you have the political desire for lower interest rates to help with household affordability, but on the other, you have fiscal policies like tax cuts and high spending that naturally drive yields upward. It's a policy sandwich that threatens the very credibility of the Treasury.
So if the Treasury tries to squeeze the long-end yields down while the Fed is simultaneously hiking to fight inflation, we just get squeezed from both sides.
Something to flag here, this is the policy sandwich risk. And there is a growing divergence in how this is being priced. As Chartbook flagged, the erosion of U.S. Treasury safety isn't a generalized shock, it's duration-specific. Research by Acharya and Laritz in 2026 shows that while the two-year Treasury still retains its hedging properties, the loss of the Treasury premium is concentrated in the 5- and 10-year tenors. Investors are specifically repricing the risk of long-term debt.
So the short-term stuff is still safe, but the long-term stuff is starting to look like a speculative bet.
It's becoming a question of sustainability rather than solvency. Since the U.S. borrows in its own currency, a classic default is unlikely. But the real danger, as several analysts have warned, is an unconventional crisis. We're talking about runaway inflation or the political co-option of the Federal Reserve's independence. If the Treasury uses buybacks to essentially dictate interest rate levels, it erodes the norm of non-interference that has existed since the 90s.
Which brings us to the Fed. Is Jerome Powell's successor, Kevin Warsh, going to be the one to tell the Treasury no, or is he just going to be part of the plumbing?
That's the trillion-dollar question. There is a real fear that the Fed is being forced into a financial repression role, similar to the 1940s, where it absorbs issuance just to keep the system from breaking. There is a growing call for a new Treasury Fed accord to explicitly define the boundaries of their interaction. FICC Focus noted that the stability of the post-war financial order depends on this. We need a clear rulebook for how much the Treasury can signal and how much the Fed is required to support.
I love the idea of a rulebook for the global economy. It sounds so much more organized than let's just buy back some bonds and hope for the best.
But the players are already acting outside the rules. Even the way the Fed manages its balance sheet is shifting. There's a push toward a treasury-only portfolio strategy. As FICC Focus pointed out, this serves as a de-risking mechanism. By shifting toward treasury bills, the Fed can build structural capacity to expand its balance sheet more easily during the next crisis without the complexity of longer-duration coupons.
But even if the Fed stays clean, the underlying math of the U.S. economy is getting much more aggressive. We're moving from a savings era to a capital demand era.
We can trace that further. We are seeing a structural reversal of the 2010s. We are moving from a regime of low nominal growth and massive global savings, largely from East Asian households, to a period of massive fiscal expansion and unprecedented private sector capital demand. This is why we're seeing the debasement trade play out in gold and Bitcoin. If you don't trust the fiscal trajectory, you move into hard assets.
And it's not just the US. We're seeing this debt-driven growth model being tested everywhere. Look at China, where local government debt is outpacing GDP growth because they can't figure out how to move from fixed asset investment to actual household consumption. It's the same fundamental error, trying to build a future on a mountain of debt without a sustainable engine of demand.
It all converges on the cost of capital. Because Treasury yields serve as the global risk-free rate floor, any increase in U.S. borrowing costs puts automatic upward pressure on the cost of capital for everyone, from a lender in Norway to a developer in Mexico.
It's a global domino effect, and the first domino is getting much heavier to hold up.
And much more expensive to insure.
Long-term bond investors need to reevaluate their duration exposure as the 5 to 10 year window becomes the primary battlefield for fiscal risk. Keep an eye on the next round of Treasury auction results. Any significant tail or failed auction will be the signal that the market is no longer willing to subsidize the deficit. But if the cost of money is rising so sharply, it's no wonder the world is pivoting toward the massive physical hardware required to power the next era of computing. $1 trillion. That is the projected capital expenditure for hyperscalers in 2027. We aren't just talking about a large budget, we are talking about a capital sucking sound so powerful it's physically reshaping the global economy.
It's more than just a large number, Maya. It's a fundamental shift in what we're actually building. We are moving into what analysts are calling the machine age, where the bottleneck for AI isn't even software architecture anymore. It's the physical reality of power, cooling, and copper.
The era of move fast and break things in code is being replaced by move slowly and wait for a transformer to arrive from overseas.
The data tells a story. The traditional software engineering bottleneck, what's famously called the mythical man month, has essentially been broken. As the A16Z show noted, we've moved to a resource-based model where you can actually convert massive capital injections directly into intelligence via compute clusters. If you throw enough chips and electricity at the problem, you get more tokens.
Which sounds less like a tech revolution and more like a heavy industry boom like the railroads or electrification.
That's exactly the comparison being made. But unlike the dot-com era, which was built on speculative dark fiber, this expansion is driven by immediate pre-sold demand. We're seeing a transition where even the tech sector is starting to look like a utility, high capital intensity, heavy debt, and massive permanent maintenance obligations.
A utility that requires massive amounts of energy and is currently hitting a very physical wall. I keep hearing about everything south of the model.
That's the phrase of the year. The constraint isn't the large language model itself, it's the physical layers beneath it. We are seeing rack power densities climb from a standard 5 to 10 kilowatts to as much as 150 kilowatts. That level of heat is impossible to manage with traditional air cooling, so the industry is being forced into liquid cooling and a dangerous transition to high voltage DC power.
Dangerous is a heavy word for a way to keep your servers from melting.
It's a literal labor crisis too. The A16Z show highlighted that only about 2% of USON electricians are currently certified to handle the high-voltage DC power required by these next-generation data centers. You can have all the capital in the world, but if you can't wire the building, the chips sit idle.
So we have the money, we have the chips, but we don't have the hands or the wires. And let's not forget the energy side. It's not just about having power, it's about not crashing the local grid to get it.
And that's where the geopolitics get messy. We're seeing a behind-the-meter energy crisis. To bypass slow-moving, regulated utility interconnects, operators are increasingly deploying their own natural gas turbines. It creates this massive paradox, where the very technology intended to optimize global efficiency is becoming a primary driver of marginal carbon emissions.
It also creates a massive asymmetric cost problem. The benefits of a massive data center are seen as abstract and national, but the cost, higher electricity rates and more water usage, is felt immediately and locally. No wonder 75% of people in U.S. counties are opposing them.
And that opposition is translating into real financial risk. UBS analysts have noted a significant divergence in how this is being funded. While direct bank lending allows for periodic draws to monitor community opposition, the emerging data center bond market offers immediate lump sum proceeds. Lenders are now treating local regulatory resistance as a specific credit risk in these bond offerings.
Which explains why we're seeing such intense regulatory activity lately. New York has a moratorium on new construction, and we just saw a Texas governor-ordered audit of interconnection requests on August 3rd.
It's a massive tug of war. On one side, you have the must-do calculus. As Macro Hive conversations with Bill O'Haffey's pointed out, this spending isn't just about chasing upside, it's an existential fear of obsolescence. If you don't build it, you lose the race. On the other side, you have the physical and political reality of 90 gigawatts of projected demand by the end of the decade.
And the money behind it is getting increasingly circular.
It's getting much more complex. Bloomberg Intelligence flagged a significant circular revenue risk. Hyperscalers like Amazon or Microsoft provide cloud credits to AI labs like Anthropic or OpenAI as part of their investment. Those labs then use those credits to buy services from the same hyperscalers. It effectively allows the giants to book their own investments back as revenue.
It's a hall of mirrors made of silicon and debt. And if NVIDIA is the center of that mirror, the stakes are even higher than the balance sheet suggests.
It's a telling detail. The Credit Edge by Bloomberg Intelligence reported that NVIDIA's off-balance sheet commitments, like the $30 billion in backstops for companies like CoreWeave, suggest their true exposure to the ecosystem is much higher than traditional accounting shows. They aren't just selling chips, they are effectively financing the very infrastructure that buys them.
It feels like the entire ecosystem is one CapEx guidance tweak away from a massive correction.
That is the primary indicator to watch. If any of the major hyperscalers signals even a 20% reduction in spending or a plateau in growth, the entire machine age thesis could fracture.
Investors need to watch the next quarterly earnings call from the big three cloud providers for any hint of a CapEx slowdown. The hardware is scaling, but the regulatory and social backlash is starting to catch up. But as the physical footprint of AI expands, the legal and political fight over how these giants operate is moving from the data center to the courtroom. We all thought the era of move fast and break things was ending because of bad vibes and bad press. But as it turns out, the real endgame isn't a decline in users. It's a massive, multi-billion dollar settlement to rewrite the rules of the playground.
You're talking about the Meta settlement. It's less about an apology and more about a fundamental structural pivot. We are seeing a massive shift from optional safety features to mandatory default-on restrictions, like disabling notifications during school hours and enforcing dark periods from midnight to 6 a.m.
It sounds less like a tech update and more like a digital curfew imposed by a very expensive group of lawyers.
Worth noting, the journal reports that Meta is effectively using a financial hostage mechanism here. They've negotiated an $18 billion settlement with 48 states, but the payout drops from $18 billion to $12 billion unless competitors like TikTok and YouTube also agree to a one-hour daily time limit and a $5.3 billion payment.
Meta isn't just paying a fine. They're essentially running a protection racket where they only lower their own bill if everyone else agrees to the same handcuffs.
It's strategic weaponized regulation. By making the settlement contingent on competitors adopting these caps, Meta is using the cost of compliance to disproportionately burden platforms that might have higher engagement volatility. They are essentially trading short-term engagement, like the revenue they previously generated from scam-related ads, to protect the massive capital expenditures required for their AI infrastructure.
It's like a restaurant chain agreeing to ban all soda sales, but only if the burger joint across the street agrees to ban milkshakes too, just so nobody gets too much energy.
A bit more high stakes, but the logic holds. This is a regulatory proxy for federal inaction. Since Congress is stuck in gridlock, state attorneys general are stepping in to implement substantive operational changes that would have taken years of litigation to achieve.
And yet, despite the $18 billion price tag, Meta's quarterly revenue is sitting at roughly $60 billion. This feels less like a punishment and more like a very expensive license to operate.
The real danger wasn't the fine, but the potential for a $1 trillion liability that could have threatened their entire market cap. By settling now, they avoid the $1 trillion tail risk while simultaneously shifting the burden of digital regulation from the user to the platform's underlying architecture.
But while Meta is busy rewriting their code to include curfews, there's another type of shadow accounting being dragged into the light in the private credit markets.
You're referring to the Guggenheim investigation. Recent grand jury subpoenas in 2026 revealed that Delaware Life and Clear Spring Life failed to properly disclose $22 billion in private credit deals linked to Guggenheim.
Which is essentially finding out your independent investment portfolio is actually just a mirror reflecting your own bank account.
Net Interest points out that the primary regulatory risk in private credit isn't the underlying assets, but the systemic circumvention of arm's-length standards through interconnected reinsurance and related party debt. When the audit happened, affiliated investments at Delaware Life jumped from a mere 3% to 42% of their total assets.
It's a massive sudden shift in reported financial health hidden behind a curtain of complexity.
To remediate that, Mark Walter is executing a massive-scale deleveraging of personal and corporate interconnectedness. He's swapping $6.5 billion of Delaware Life's related party investments for independent assets and even divesting high-profile stakes like the LA Lakers to reduce that visibility.
It seems the theme for 2026 is transparency, whether you like it or not.
It's a fundamental reassessment of how much interconnectedness an institutional investor can hide before the regulators stop looking at the books and start looking at the people.
State attorneys general will now be looking for these same leaky sieve tactics in every major tech merger. Watch for the outcome of the October 2026 school district trials to see if the settlement holds or if the litigation floodgates truly open. But if the legal landscape is becoming this much more regulated and rigid, how does that change the way even the most basic cultural conflicts are fought online? I don't know, Alex. I think we're overestimating the danger of a few pink pig emojis and some poorly edited TikToks. It's hard to believe a cute aesthetic is fundamentally rewriting the rules of engagement or destabilizing global power structures.
It's not just about the aesthetic, Maya. It's about the strategic shift in how states manufacture consent. As ChinaTalk noted, this memification represents a move away from traditional appeals to honor toward a vibe patriotism designed to desensitize populations to the actual human costs of conflict.
So what, we're just one viral dance away from a full-scale invasion of Taiwan? First, we lose our sense of gravity, then we lose our grip on reality, and finally, we're all just scrolling through a live stream of a drone strike that's been edited to look like a level in Fortnite.
That's exactly the mechanism at play. The Trump administration's Department of War is already utilizing video game mechanics, using wiped prompts from Grand Theft Auto and Wii Sports sound effects, to transform real-world bombing footage into low-stakes, consumable entertainment.
It sounds like a nightmare for anyone trying to hold a government accountable. If the footage is indistinguishable from a gaming montage, how do you even begin to audit the actual kinetic impact?
You can't, because the technology is closing that gap. We're seeing an era where AI allows both the US and China to blend real combat footage with lighthearted animations, creating a veneer of fakeness that masks the harshness of war. The goal isn't truth, it's engagement. When a White House bowling pin video reaches 103 million views, the metric of success is the viral reach in the attention economy, not the promotion of military values.
It's essentially Taobao-style marketing, but for missiles.
China is using cute animal filters and trending soundtracks on platforms like Douyin to neutralize potential backlash against military modernization. It creates a psychological buffer. If the expansion looks like a trending social media aesthetic, it feels less like a geopolitical escalation and more like a domestic trend.
It's a terrifying way to bypass the friction of public dissent.
And it's happening alongside a massive structural shift in how these powers sustain themselves. While we watch the digital propaganda, the underlying hardware is being rebuilt. The Grant Williams podcast highlighted that the U.S.-Japan relationship is transitioning into a fusion of balance sheets centered on industrial capacity and IP, with Japan's manufacturing helping to rebuild American defense capabilities that the U.S. can no longer sustain alone.
So the memes are the software, but the hardware is becoming a permanent, integrated fixture of the new West.
While the digital front is being gamified to keep us distracted, the physical integration of these defense industrial bases is moving toward a state of irreversible interdependence.
Institutional investors need to watch for any sudden decoupling in U.S.-Japan defense supply chains.
Keep an eye on the next major military procurement announcement from the Pentagon to see if it carries that same gamified branding or stays grounded in traditional technical specifications.
But if the digital landscape is becoming this distorted, I wonder if we'll see a similar blurring of boundaries in how we handle the next wave of digital currencies and decentralized finance. I was looking at my grocery receipt this morning and realized I'm basically paying a premium for the privilege of watching fiat currencies evaporate in real time. It feels like we're living through a slow-motion liquidation of everything we thought was solid.
That's exactly the vibe of the current macro landscape, Maya. We're seeing a massive shift in how we define money, moving from a centralized reliance on the use treasury toward a competition of near-moneyness. As Thoughts on the Market recently noted, the rise of stablecoins and CBDCs is creating this massive pressure on traditional banks, where non-financial sectors are now directly competing for deposits.
So basically, the Fed is about to find out that they're no longer the only game in town for liquidity.
And it's not just about tech, it's about the breakdown of the credibility limits, fiscal, economic, and inflationary, that used to back the dollar. Daniel Lackall argues that because governments have overshot the limits of debt issuance, we're seeing a loss of confidence in state money. The Trump administration's strategy seems to be a pivot. Instead of defending the dollar through central control, they're positioning the U.S. as the godfather of the crypto revolution to maintain dominance through stablecoins.
Right, because why bother with boring old policy when you can just embrace the chaos of the blockchain? Honestly, the idea that we're transitioning from a sovereign debt era to a tokenized collateral era sounds like something a sci-fi writer dreamed up during a fever dream.
It is wild, but look at the real-world hedge, emerging markets. While developed nations experiment with fringe frameworks like MMT, FICC Focus highlights that M central banks are actually being more orthodox. They hiked early during the inflation shocks and are holding steady. Because they've aggressively deleveraged their dollar-denominated debt, they aren't as vulnerable to dollar spikes anymore. In fact, as FICC Focus points out, the expansion of domestic savings in these markets is improving their Sharpe ratio by increasing the ratio of carry to volatility.
While the West is busy re-engineering the plumbing of the global reserve, the real alpha is in the disciplined players.
There's a signal here. If you want a specific play, the macro trading floor suggests looking at the Czech koruna against the Polish zloty, driven by the Czech's ability to expand deficits for investment versus Poland's approaching debt limit.
Global macro investors should start reweighting toward deleveraged M sovereigns that are prioritizing balance sheet strength over stimulus. Watch the next round of U.S. Treasury auctions to see if the appetite for sovereign paper can actually withstand this shift toward tokenized alternatives. As we close out this Friday, a single thread binds today's landscape: the transition from an era of intangible software-driven growth to one of brutal physical constraints. Whether we are looking at the massive energy requirements of a trillion-dollar AI buildout or the structural instability of a $40 trillion national debt, the friction is no longer in the code, it is in the atoms. We are seeing the era of scalable, low-cost expansion hit the hard reality of power grids, specialized hardware, and the sheer fiscal weight of the modern state.
That's the crux of it. This isn't just about volatility, it's a fundamental shift in how institutional capital must be deployed. For the major hyperscalers like Microsoft and Amazon, the calculus has shifted from optimizing algorithms to securing the physical foundations of computing, kilowatts, and cooling. Simultaneously, for the U.S. Treasury, the challenge is no longer just managing interest rates, but managing the identity of the holders themselves as highly leveraged players enter the long end of the curve. The strategic implication is clear. The next decade of market leadership won't be decided by who has the best model, but by who can successfully integrate massive energy procurement with sustainable sovereign debt management.
The pattern is clear. The margin for error in this new industrial fiscal complex is incredibly thin.
So as you head into the weekend, keep a close eye on the next round of Treasury auction results. If we see a significant widening in spreads on those 5 and 10-year tenors, it will confirm that the market is no longer willing to absorb this expansion of debt without a massive premium for the risk.
That's the signal that could break the current consensus. Thanks for joining us this evening. We'll see you on Monday for a deep dive into the emerging trade corridors in East Asia.